KBOO Portland, your listener-supported, volunteer-run community radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the show this morning. The music you just heard is a Palestinian song called Eben El Balad. Before we get into our show, I want to remind you about the listener-supported part of KBOO. We do depend on your generosity to stay on the air. If you missed the opportunity to donate during our most recent fund drive, you can still go to kboo.fm/donate, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KBOO app. Everyone at KBOO thanks you for your generous support. The moles like to dig around in the dirt to excavate the forces behind the problems of our contemporary world, to understand the root causes of threats to security, equality, and democracy. Today, we have commentary for you on two headline-grabbing issues. We'll start off with a discussion between Jan Hocken and social theorist Emmeline Friedman on the significance of the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried, the crypto wunderkind. We'll close our show by turning to the heartbreaking and outrageous violence being perpetrated in our name and with our dollars against Palestinian citizens, as Bill Resnick speaks to Middle East scholar David Finkel. In between, I'll review the Pulitzer Prize-winning Civil War novel, March, by Geraldine Brooks, who takes an unflinching look at a man of conviction who goes to war and the devastating consequences of the choices he makes in service to his convictions. Sam Bankman-Fried, the biggest financial fraudster we've seen in the U.S. since Bernie Madoff, recently got his just deserts for his grand ripoff. Jen Hocken speaks with psychologist, social theorist, and expert on the digital world, Emmeline Friedman, about the social and economic conditions that enabled him to dupe so many people.
Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Emmeline Friedman.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, you're a social theorist and author and a psychotherapist, and you've been on the show before to talk about crypto and some of the technologies underlying this digital currency. The jury trial of Sam Bankman-Fried over the past month has rocked the world of crypto with what some describe as the biggest financial fraud case in history. Bankman-Fried was charged with 7 counts of wire fraud and conspiracy to launder money for his role in the multi-billion dollar collapse of FTX in 2022 and pleaded not guilty. On November 2nd, and after a short period of deliberations, the jury found him guilty of 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy. He could spend the rest of his life in jail. Well, Emmeline Friedman, there are different ways of looking at this case from a social psychological perspective. How do you make sense of the dramatic rise and fall of Bankman-Fried?
Yeah, you know, the way that I look at the rise and fall of Bankman-Fried is, of course, through the lens of the particular stage of finance capitalism in which we find ourselves. And I very much think that both his rise and his fall are really rather symptomatic of this current moment in what some even describe as kind of the withering end stages of capitalism in this interregnum where, you know, it's not really a prime time for capitalism, but we also don't know what's coming next.
And of course, America has a rich history of financial fraudsters with their fates riding the wild currents of capitalist crises, market fevers, and boom bust cycles. Some of these are related to the rise of neoliberalism and the logic and expansion of markets throughout the late 20th century. How is this? The fate of Bankman-Fried and his troubles related to this phase of finance capitalism.
Yeah, so I mean, we can talk about Bankman-Fried as a crypto entrepreneur and how he got his start, and maybe we should begin there. But also, you know, the market appetite for what Bankman-Fried was serving up, I think, also deserves some mention in this regard.
And I think just to set the stage for that, of course, he was described as a mad genius, math nerd who got in over his head. People loved him and his persona that he cultivated as too busy and serious to worry about things like what he wore or his hair. A lot of his style and brand were taken up in the critique of him and in the trial. But you're saying there he had an audience that nurtured his arrogance, perhaps.
Yeah. You know, in reflecting on the trial, like what occurs to me as someone who works in the realm of peer-to-peer technologies, distributed and crypto technologies, what comes up to me is really what it says about the consumer appetite for taking huge risks, like extremely risky bets. And the way that Bankman-Fried was able to build up FTX and earn such a major boatload of money because there is consumer appetite for, you know, taking these highly leveraged bets, basically, on the coming to fruition of new technologies. And I think that, you know, you mentioned neoliberalism before. I think that in this kind of every man for himself attitude of, you know, radical flexibility and the need to kind of combine hard work with unreal, totally unrealistic optimism, that creating a market for taking these sort of leveraged bets is gonna have the appeal that Bankman-Fried's industry is showing us.
Yeah, and I noticed some of the ads by famous actors and basketball players would describe FTX as a place to put your money safely in crypto without having to understand what it's about, so that it spared you putting your money in this exchange from untangling the mystifying world of crypto. Was that also part of the problem of FTX and how he was able to pull, I guess, $8 billion out of that fund to use for his own purposes?
Yeah, so remember that FTX and Alameda Research, the you know the associated entity that really came under fire during the trial, both of those businesses came up when Bankman-Fried decided to take advantage of the an arbitrage opportunity. He saw that you could buy Bitcoin cheaply in the US and sell it for a huge markup in Japan.
That was part of his so-called brilliance, right?
Yeah, the brilliance there was spotting this international arbitrage opportunity. So basically, he was able to take a financial savvy that he had gained through, traditional Wall Street, and parlay it into a kind of a pioneering position in the big money game of crypto exchanges, which does exactly as you're describing. Not only does it kind of sell safety in crypto markets in this kind of egregious and fallacious at face value anyway, but also, of course, what he was accused of was kind of being himself the sort of consumer that he was building for by using customer deposits and parlaying them into a bunch of weird, illiquid moonshot technology investments.
The prosecutor used this phrase when he in his summary arguments at the end of the trial, describing him as a scammer and a liar who built a pyramid of deceit. And of course, that uses the term pyramid, like a pyramid scheme, which could describe more clearly the Madoff situation. And he too rose and fell during the financial crisis of 2008, that had made reckless bets on mortgage-backed securities collapse, and investors scrambled to put money out of the stock market. And a similar thing here, where people started questioning the good news and the happy talk of Bankman-Fried and started to make withdrawals. Do you see this as a similar kind of pyramid scheme that Bernie Madoff was pursuing, or it's different in a certain way?
I think it's really only different aesthetically, right? Like I'm thinking of what you said about, how Bankman-Fried also embodies, and let's talk about the kind of culture that he's coming out of. He really embodies this kind of casual, laissez-faire, really the kind of Silicon Valley tech genius that I think we some of us love to love, some of us love to hate, but he really embodies this sort of like innocence and naivete of Silicon Valley tech capitalism, but really had the savvy and in fact the math genius of a Wall Street trader, such that he was able to undergird the Ponzi scheme that he was knowingly operating. There are great interviews actually from, the heyday of crypto 2018, 2019 of Bankman-Fried on Bloomberg, talking about crypto yield farming as really describing it in broad daylight as a Ponzi scheme. And so I think that there's this funny way that the Silicon Valley culture of wearing shorts and a t-shirt and playing video games during interviews with policymakers, I think it combines in a funny way with the sort of big money Ponzi schemes that someone like Madoff is capable of, and kind of creates the figure who just got sentenced on 7 counts of fraud.
Yeah, Madoff was also a kind of genius of finance and leader in his industry. In Wall Street, he was chairman of his investment firm and served as the head of the NASDAQ stock exchange and developed innovative strategies in the field of markets. And I think that's part of the drama and a kind of identity crisis, I guess, that those who believe in the arc of history moving toward markets, that these were very idealized figures. And so the fall was particularly dramatic. And how do then also weigh what is their genius? Is it all a charade? Was there anything Bankman-Fried was doing that would warrant the idealization or admiration that he clearly generated?
I sincerely believe that he was trying to create an increasingly more frictionless global financial system. I think that he participated and again truly believed in this sort of dream of decentralization whereby capital flows as freely as air, basically.
Isn't that a principle of neoliberalism?
Oh, in every way, certainly. Yeah, and ultimately, you can see how this sort of thinking specifically benefits folks like Bankman-Fried, who know exactly the sorts of international arbitrage opportunities. Like in a way, I think with crypto, he wanted to solve some of his own problems in terms of running into delays, with wires, for example, things like that. But he also believed, and this is it's interesting to think about the culture he's coming out of too in building this business, because he also subscribed to effective altruism,
Yeah,
right?
let's talk about that and how much that was part of how he raised money, right? I mean, all the way back to JP Morgan, the world of finance capitalism and the titans of capitalism have built their justification for concentration of wealth on their philanthropy. And JP Morgan, funded a lot of museums and early 20th century institutions that had actually something solid to them. But it also, of course, is part of how all of that wealth and concentration of wealth gets justified through philanthropy. And it was apparently a big part of how he appealed to investors was through this philosophy of effective altruism. So can you explain that a bit and the principles behind that?
Yeah. So in essence, with the JP Morgan comparison, there's nothing new under the sun in the sense that, the justification for his unbelievable earnings and indeed for building a whole crypto empire, is that the plan is to give that all away. And I actually don't think we can, in a sense, the justification has gotten both thicker and thinner. Thicker in the sense that the way that this all started for Bankman-Fried, he was getting a degree in physics from MIT when he met William McCaskill, who's the kind of leader of this effective altruism movement.
They were
Caskill
a group of
told
Oxford philosophers, right?
precisely.
Sounds
This
like
was
a much better direction than JP Morgan.
Right. Get the Oxford philosophers on your side, right? And in this fated meeting, McCaskill told Bankman-Fried about this revolutionary idea, right, about earning to give. And he told Bankman-Fried flat out that someone with his mathematical talents should pursue a high-paying Wall Street job and donate all of his earnings to charity. And not only charity, though, right? Like, effective altruism has an extremely heavy-handed way of looking at this. As psychologists, maybe we can see it's kind of more and more compensatory in an era of ever greater wealth inequality. But the ideology of effective altruism is really one that values extremes. So the idea being that if all lives are equally valuable, then we should save trillions of potential lives in the future than the billions of lives on the planet today. So, that's one example from effective altruism about how this justification of philanthropism can kind of run completely rampant, and justify like any technology development that makes big promises, about saving lives in the future, rather than trying to solve like the smaller, messier, more immediate problems that, that we're surely facing today.
Yeah, and it seems like there were, as I understand it, there are kind of two legs to this walk through their world. One is the appeal to not be burdened by the boards and the regulations and processes of nonprofits and government programs for the poor or social welfare, that these smart guys know how to do it directly.
It's
And
much more heroic, right, than
that's
working with the
right.
government.
Yeah, and also not be burdened by regulation. Just make as much money as you can and then dispense it to what you deem worthwhile in responding to human needs. Of course, the arrogance of that is that they are very removed from the daily struggle of people in the context of social welfare programs or social programs or nonprofits, which have, of course, their own limits and forms of corruption. But this idea that you could ride above it all, some smart guys in the room can figure all this stuff out on their own, was also then exposed by the second leg of this journey through that world, which was Bankman-Fried and many of the other super uber wealthy investors who adopted this philosophy were using a lot of that money for yachts and planes and mansions. And he was not the monk that he presented himself as. And I think
Yeah.
that was exposed as part of the hypocrisy around his whole act.
Absolutely. I mean, this ultimately, those in the effective altruism crowd, we're talking not just Sam Bankman-Fried, but also Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Vitalik Buterin, some of the most wealthy white men in this world, right? Are very opportunistically sort of using this philosophy, which, it should be noted, does not even require that you give your wealth away in your lifetime, but potentially in your will, right? So it kind of opens the door to be able to, do everything that one would expect, of business as usual capitalism, indefinitely rolling your earnings into building up your empire. And then maybe something happens down the line in your will. But it just goes to show, like earlier this year, Sam Bankman-Fried donated less to charity than his firm spent on rights to name the Miami Heat's arena. So this was $90 million, right? And of course that spend is justified on the basis that, well, I'm still alive, and so I'm still
Making
building
as
up
much
my
money as I can.
empire, yeah, for future, just kind of shoving off, same way as he did with, risk in leveraging customer funds, just kind of delaying to this indefinite future.
Well, before we close, Emmeline, I have to ask you about Elizabeth Holmes. We've been talking about the profiles and corruption in the history of capitalist geniuses who were exposed in their fraudulence. But she had a similar entrepreneurial scheme. She, of course, didn't feel she could perform to investors in sloppy clothes and cargo pants. She had a very different brand. But she also was someone who, appealed to investors, and like Bankman-Fried, her defense at the end was that she thought it hadn't been given a good enough chance, that she could have turned things around if only the wind at her sails had been less ferocious. They both had a similar defense at the end of their trials, that they had a good idea. But the forces against them were driven by the market, and they could have turned things around given enough time. What's your take on that final appeal they both offered? And of course, how she, as one of the few women entrepreneurs who's convicted of fraud, now she's got a 9-year sentence. How did she fit that mold?
Yeah, at the end of the day, when both of these entrepreneurs are coming with their hats in their hands to the juries, they're going to appeal to the dream that is kind of forced upon all of us, right? Like they're going to paint themselves as someone who tried their best, but ultimately like the rest of us, are kind of just enslaved to market forces that are beyond our control. And so I think it's telling the sort of gender differences between them. Not only did it take Elizabeth Holmes' jury much longer to come to an opinion, she also, curated her appearance and kind of gained her legitimacy through different cultural tropes. But I think it's right to look at this sort of great equalization that they kind of paint this general portrait of neoliberal subjectivity in their moments of truth, which is that I've tried to be adaptive and optimistic, and I've worked really damn hard, but ultimately here we are all quivering in the face of Mr. Market, right?
Well, I must say I agree with the jury verdict here, and although I do feel sad for Sam Bankman-Fried's parents, who are of course implicated in all of this in various ways, but he's a product of forces not entirely of his own making.
I agree. I echo your sentiments about his family. I think a lot of Democrats are wondering, like, okay, what about all of his campaign contributions? Like, will his political donations have to be returned too?
In one interview, he said he gave as much to Republicans as Democrats, but had to do it as dark money because it wasn't part of his brand.
Right. Well, of course, his mother is the one with the Democratic donor network. So I'm sure, it involved him kind of sidestepping some family norms too, in order to push through the sorts of crypto regulation that he wanted to see, right? Which, of course, is going to be spearheaded by the GOP.
Right. There is a denouement here, but the dramas will continue. He will not probably be the last of the fraudsters in finance that we see in our economy.
Yeah, I sure hope it sends a message, I sure hope it sends a message that the sort of flippant attitude that he had, I mean, he really curated this image. This was something that came out from Caroline Ellison, his ex-girlfriend and business partner, that he really curated this image of being nonchalant and kind of ludic and playful and nary a care. And I think that, maybe if this has an effect on the tech world, I hope that it is, to at least act as if you plan on being responsible with customer funds and things like that. And just maybe from having to act as if, it actually does create a little bit more prudence.
Sobering indeed.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much, Emmeline Friedman, for being with me today to talk about the rise and fall and trial of Sam Bankman-Fried.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Becoming a threat. So will we. You know rappers like to rock pools. I got pools, you can't swim in, but I'm collecting a spice like a Fremen. So you fools get stepping and get to choosing your weapon, because the deafening roar of indefinite war is epic. I found a new way to debit the people. I generate an address and I generate a sequel. I get medieval when I'm taking payment, because I don't want the NSA all stuck up in my anus. Yeah, and I'm a Bitcoin fair and I'm staring the status quo. Got that crypto going and that foul to blow. And the algorithm gonna get them until prison sentence. Drugs, but you do it on the streets and you did it in Google Buzz or Google Plus. There's a road made of silk if you must. Get your hustle out of chemical rush, avoiding the brush.
That music clip was from a song called Bitcoin Baron by Y.T. Cracker. Before that, Jan Hawkins spoke with Emmeline Friedman about the rise and fall of financial fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Our usual book mole, Larry Bolden, is taking a break, and I am stepping in to fill his big shoes with a review of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Geraldine Brooks called March. It is set before and during the Civil War. Mr. March, a protagonist who tells his own tale, is a self-righteous man with clear convictions. He's a man of ideas, a transcendentalist who has dreams of living in community where men and women thrive together in harmony with each other and with nature. March, a staunch abolitionist, has contempt for those who fail to act on their convictions. Concord, March says of his own hometown, quote, remained a forest of wagging fingers whose citizens were content to condemn, yet unprepared to do anything material against the system that provided their mills with cotton. March's moral commitment to action will prove to be his undoing. Fans of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott will quickly realize that the character March is the missing father of the four fictional girls. He is loosely based on Bronson Alcott, the father of Louisa May. The story unfolds over the horrific year of March's service, first as chaplain and later as teacher in the Union Army. Woven into the story are flashbacks of March's pre-war years as a man who has made and lost a fortune, with cameo appearances by Nathaniel Hawthorne, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, and John Brown, all of whom make up March's intellectual milieu. Brown's ill-fated rebellion plant the first seeds of doubt in March's mind. He's confounded by Brown's resort to violence, asking, quote, was ever a course of action more reckless and savage? Was ever one so justifiable and so self-sacrificing? As chaplain in the Union Army, March re-encounters the slave woman, Grace, whom he'd first met years earlier as a callow peddler wandering the South. Grace, a house servant and daughter of the white master, is a woman of considerable refinement, intelligence, beauty, and wisdom, with whom March is besotted, despite being married and devoted to his firebrand wife. Grace, as an enslaved black person, makes choices that befuddle and outrage March. She responds to him, quote, if you live with your head in the lion's mouth, it's best to stroke it some. Due to his own indiscretion, March is reposted from the battle lines to a Union-held southern plantation, where supposedly it will be proven that cotton could be profitably grown by so-called free black labor. The blacks here, as it turns out, are treated scant better than when they were enslaved. It is here that March comes face to face with the terrible contradictions and consequences of his convictions. The narrative is beautifully rendered, largely in March's voice, with carefully researched and fascinating period details. It's a narrative as well that plays constantly with the tension between beliefs and actions. It's a story about war in all of its savagery and contradictions and corruption on both sides. It's a story about the brutal ironies of slavery, the mechanisms by which it was enforced, and the narratives that were told to justify it. It's a portrait of a marriage which staggers under the weight of moral failings and truths deliberately withheld. It's an exploration of the myriad ways that women are made to suffer through armed conflict perpetrated by men. But the most profound story for me is that of the man, March, who learns through circumstances in which there are no good choices that he is not the man he aspired to be. In his letters back to his beloved wife, he evades the truth of both the depravity he has witnessed and his weaknesses in the face of it. Those letters serve as much to deceive himself as to deceive her. In the end, March has no way back to the moral certainty he once possessed. He confesses to his wife, Marmee, "I valued my principles more than I valued their lives, and the outcome is they are slaves again, or dead." She replies that he is not God and that the outcome is not the point. "Then what, pray, is the point?" he cries. "The point," Marmee says, "is the effort to believe and not to act, or to act in a way that every fiber of your soul held was wrong. That is what would have been reprehensible. But that effort is also what led to disastrous consequences for the very people March wanted to save." Geraldine Brooks offers no answer to this conundrum. Grace, whose own choices confounded this reader, is perhaps a character too noble to be believed. But she offers this advice to March, the man who now despises himself. She says, "You'll have to stop wallowing in this notion that you are somehow at fault in all the ill things that have happened this year. War is full of misfortune. Cannot you see? It is folly to let this self-flagellation shape your future." But March, as Grace recognizes, is a man who's been dipped in a river of fire and is no longer the man he once was. This is a story that resonates in our world today, if not with the totality of human history. It is dark and bleak, yet admits a sliver of hope in the end. This is Book Mole, Patricia Kullberg, for the Old Mole Variety Hour, with a review of March, a novel by Geraldine Brooks.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. But his soul goes marching on. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through. They hanged him for a traitor, they themselves the traitor crew. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. Well, he's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on.
That music was Pete Seeger's song, John Brown's Body. Before that, you heard my review of the novel March by Geraldine Brooks. Hamas's savage attack on Israel October 7 has unleashed an even more savage attack by Israel on the Gaza Strip, where 2 million innocent Palestinians no longer have any safe place to hide. Attacks on Gaza are nothing new, but the outbreak of violence this time appears to be shifting world opinion in favor of the long-suffering Palestinian people. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with Middle East scholar David Finkel about the significance of the shifting winds of global sympathy.
Hi, David Finkel. Welcome again to KABU.
Good morning.
David Finkel is the editor of the journal Against the Current. He's also a prolific writer, hundreds of pieces on the U.S. and international politics. He specializes in U.S. imperialist machinations and the Middle East, particularly in Israel-Palestine, the struggle. And he's very critical of the current Zionist project and its U.S. partner. So, David, in the last month after Hamas's savage, murderous, and senseless attack, killing over 1,000 Israelis, 400 of them children, taking 200 hostages, Israel responded, revealing itself as just as murderous and far more lethal in pursuing its long-term goal that, as you point out, is to ethnically cleanse the entire territory and keep enlarging the Jewish state. Thus, after a month of bombardment of helpless people, killing over 10,000 Gazans, 4,000 of them children, injuring over 25,000, and destroying hospitals, the few that are still operating are running out of medicine or electricity for use of medical equipment. So, David, tell us how you understand the 75 years after World War II, how and why the Israeli colonizers, how they became so empowered and so racist in believing Palestinians' lives didn't mean much, and how its hatred of Palestinians has eventuated in the current tragedy and catastrophe for those colonized people.
Well, the conflict between the Arab-Palestinian population in Palestine and the Zionist colonial project dated back well before World War II, and it was far from entirely peaceful. However, up until the Nazi genocide, there was no possibility for the Zionist movement to attract enough support among the Jewish population of the world, particularly Europe, to have any possibility of creating a Jewish majority country, even in part of Palestine. It was the Nazi genocide that brought the massive influx of survivors from the Holocaust into Palestine. Some of them went there from conviction. Many others, many more probably, went to Palestine because all the other major countries were closed to them. They couldn't get into the United States. They couldn't get into most Western European countries. And this restriction was in collusion with the Zionist leadership, which wanted those survivors of the Nazi Holocaust to have no other place to go than Palestine. Now, it's really impossible to cover all this in a short discussion. I think there are two absolutely essential books to read on the subject. One of them is professor and historian Rashid Khalidi's latest book called The 100 Years War on Palestine, and the other, focusing on the immediate period of the formation of the State of Israel, is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by the Israeli historian Ilan Pape, and I really recommend those. Now, that's the beginning of the story of the Israeli state. It was born in both the tragedy of the Nazi genocide in Europe and also the planned and very well organized ethnic cleansing of Palestine by the Zionist movement leadership and its militias, particularly Haganah, which became what is now called the Israeli Defense Force. So that's the story in brief.
Yeah. One thing that puzzled me, the Zionist dream that I was subjected to in my Sunday school classes as the little blue can was passed around to all of the assembled Hebrews. The Zionist dream before World War II had a utopian element. that the Jews would return Israel to the land of milk and honey, or reforest the desert. It would be egalitarian. All material production by cooperatives, workers participating and running the enterprise as the owners. Even child rearing was a community responsibility, at least some Jewish dreams, with the children all living in children's quarters that the biological parents were encouraged to visit. Some of these kibbutzins exist, but aren't much different than the rest of Israel. The dream has ended. But what happened to it? There were a lot of kibbutzins set up that were pretty radical in the early years.
Well, what you and also, to some extent, I was taught in our Sunday schools, that was one version of the Zionist dream. It wasn't the only one.
No.
There was a wing of the Zionist movement called Revisionist Zionism, right-wing, pro-capitalist, and the forerunners of today's Likud party, actually, who had a vision of a state, if you want to say, from the river to the sea, a Jewish state from the river to the sea. They did not mean the Jordan River, they meant the Euphrates River. Now, obviously, that was not attainable. There were always different currents in Zionism. What killed, if you like, the vision embodied in the kibbutzim and the Zionist left was two things. First of all, it's racism, because it was based on the vision of a utopia for Jews from which Arab labor was excluded. And secondly, it died after 1977 when the right wing came to power. Again, that was, again, partially because of the racism of labor Zionism, which looked down on the immigrants from North Africa and the Arab world, who were called, they're incorrectly called Sephardim, it's more accurately Mizrahim, who became the actual Israeli working class and who were treated with contempt by the elites of labor Zionism. Then, subsequently, from the 1980s and 1990s, Israel underwent its neoliberal revolution, in which it became ultra-capitalist, if you like, and became one of the least egalitarian countries in the world. As a matter of fact, of all the countries with advanced economies, Israel is the second most unequal in the world. And I leave your readers to guess which is the most unequal country in the world. You can chant USA, USA, if you like, if you want a hint.
Well, thanks for the hint. Let's skip to the 1967 war, the run-up to the war and its consequences, which at least I hypothesize was solidification of a new Jewish identity as the warrior Jew. What's your sense of that?
Yes, I mean, the version that we were all told was that Israel was attacked by the surrounding Arab armies and won a miraculous victory. The actual history is that the Israeli military and government deliberately provoked a war that they knew they would win. They knew they would win. Basically, they suckered the Egyptian and Syrian governments into it, and the result was the overwhelming Israeli military victory. But let me read you something. Here is a statement which was published in Haaretz, signed by a number of Israeli progressives and leftists. In September 1967, shortly after the war, here's what they wrote. Occupation entails foreign rule. Foreign rule entails resistance. Resistance entails repression. Repression entails terror and counterterror. Victims of terror are mostly innocent people. Holding on to the occupied territories will make us into a nation of murderers and murder victims. Okay? That's what was predicted by Israeli progressives and leftists right after the 1967 war, and it is, in many ways, the story of all these subsequent decades. It was also after the 1967 war that U.S. support for Israel became really consolidated. When Israel showed that it could smash what had supposedly been the most powerful armies in, you know, what was then called the Third World, it became an enormous asset for the projection of U.S. military power and hegemony throughout the region and even beyond. So that's the other part of the story.
Yeah. My sense is that the 67 war and the victory over the weak and poorly led Arab attack, the notion that was promulgated, that was, as I recall, never again would Jews be docile sheep herded into concentration camps to be murdered. Every Israeli, except of course the Orthodox, also the women, were trained to be fighters. And that was sort of the birth, it seems to me, of the warrior Jew, the tough guys who will not accept defeat and know how to defend themselves and more. This is Bill Resnick for Cable's Old Mole Variety Hour. The variety, of course, is in the variety of struggles from below that we cover. I'm talking today to Dave Finkel, the editor of the journal Against the Current, a prolific writer, hundreds of pieces in U.S. and international politics, a specialist in U.S. imperialist machinations in the Middle East, particularly concerning Israel-Palestine, the increasingly deadly conflict. So, David, in the run-up and conclusion of the 1967 war, Israel became an armed camp, most citizens armed and trained for battle. And the rest of the world and Israeli business elites feared war exploding in the Middle East and impacting oil production, which generated a continual international effort to develop a peace process based on a two-state solution. So why did that peace process, a long effort over time by various parties, including the U.S., but as Dave will tell you, they were like the labor leader who went right to the head of the parade and sounded militant, but in fact they go to the head of the parade to slow things down, as the joke goes. Why did it fail?
Well, the two-state solution, of course, never had much chance, partly because no Israeli government ever accepted it. And the United States also firmly vetoed any resolution in the United Nations or anything on the ground that could have made the two-state solution realistic. I would say that the international pressure for it built up. And finally, in the 1990s, the United States found a way to kill the two-state solution, namely by embracing it in a way that strangled it. That is, the Clinton administration, in terms of the Oslo Accords and various other things, embraced the two-state solution and then proceeded to kill anything that might have produced any progress toward it, and in particular, failing or refusing to take any measures that would have put real pressure on Israel to stop settlement expansion and the institutionalization of a colonial apartheid-like matrix of control in the West Bank, and also Gaza, which is its own horrific story. But you've had this thing called a peace process, and you had American negotiators like Dennis Ross and even Aaron David Miller, who are now appearing on cable TV as pundits, who accomplished the feat of keeping a so-called peace process going for two decades, which never produced any peace. And so by verbally embracing the two-state solution, the United States and Israel succeeded in strangling it to the point where it's now effectively dead. It has been effectively dead for quite some time. It would never have been a perfect solution. Sometimes I like to say it was the worst solution except for all of the others. Paraphrase something that Winston Churchill once said about democracy. But it could have led towards more progressive dynamics. But that period of the struggle is over, and it's not at all clear what could replace it.
Yeah. Okay. So far, we've described the birth of Israel in 1948 when its army killed or drove out the majority of the Palestinians and formed the boundaries of the initial state of Israel. Then we discussed when that initial Israel suffered an attack from Egypt and Syria that Israel really easily defeated and then took over much more land.
Finally, we discussed the long period when Israel was forced to cooperate in the peace process, indeed signed the peace agreement, but at the end, attacked the Palestinians for insisting on more concessions than Israel promised. They just dug in and refused to sign it. The Palestinians denied that they insisted on more, but without a peace partner, that was the end of the peace process and also a two-state solution. In part two, coming up in the next month, we discuss how Israel cleverly supported Hamas. Why? As a counterweight to the Palestine Liberation Organization that Israel thought was more dangerous to them, which was, of course, a huge mistake by Israel's military intelligence. We'll discuss today's deadly battles, Hamas's initial attack, and Israel's disproportionate genocidal bombardment. That's in part two, introduced in part one, but in part two, we'll center on it. And we will discuss the possibilities of a real peace process. You get the last word. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Okay, well, thanks very much. And I guess my appeal would be, wherever you are, whatever you can do, get into the streets to demand an immediate ceasefire. That doesn't address fundamental problems, which we can't solve on our own. But it is essential to raise the heat, raise the temperature to demand an immediate ceasefire, because there are already over 10,000 deaths, and in the next week, it'll be 20,000. And so it is absolutely essential to foreground that demand right now, right here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for talking to us today, Dave. We've run out of time, but I think we're going to be broadcasting this interview and maybe several others on Israel-Palestine in the next months. Be prepared for my phone call.
Thanks.
That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks to Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, and John Nelson for his editing assistance. Our gratitude as well to our guests, Emmeline Friedman and David Finkel. And we want to remind you that we could not be on the air without the hard behind-the-scenes work of the KBOO staff. Join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm going to leave you with a little more of the Palestinian song called Eben El Balad. Thanks for listening.